Mr. Birchold had such an effervescent, wonderful personality. We became very good friends.
He was so engaged with the kids, too. I mean, he really was fun. And
he could give me a great feeling about myself. I was attracted to him.
Jan Broberg and Robert Birchold had an unnatural relationship.
I loved him as deeply as I've ever loved anyone.
My brother was always a sexual pervert. He always did like his little girls.
Birchold said, I want to take Jan out horseback riding. When she didn't come home, I was a little nervous.
It was a nationwide search.
Jan went with me voluntarily. They bring in aliens and mind washing.
The mission was that I was to have a child that would save the alien planet by the time I turned 16.
The Brobergs say the attacks still continue.
If you're laying a trap for me, I'll kill you.
His number one goal was to seduce Jan Broberg. And if he had to destroy the family, he would do it.
There'll never be anybody for me but Jan. Never.
Jan had probably the most ebullient personality of any child I had ever known. She was just so outgoing. She was our first, and she was a firecracker.
Jan was kind of my champion. I was very shy as a child, and she was not.
My earliest childhood memories would be with my two sisters, Karen and Susan. They're younger than I am by 2 years each. Karen's the middle child, Susan's the baby. And I was, you know, definitely the big sister, the bossy one.
My sisters and I really, we were really good friends. I mean, we played together. We had a good, just what I consider normal childhood, just real free and easy.
We lived in Pocatello, Idaho. We had the type of a neighborhood that you never locked your doors. Always open. You could trust everyone in the neighborhood.
My mom and dad were, you know, very kind of traditional, just really sweet parents. My mom was at home. I always remember coming home after school. My mom would be ironing. My father's a florist, owned a flower shop for 40 years. I was completely loved. I was completely secure. I mean, we were listened to. And I think that was crucial for all of us surviving what we did.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. And this is the first time in my tenure at Real Crime Profile that my experience as a casting director is actually relevant, actually relevant and connected to a victim of our next case in a very weird twist of fate. I cast our guest today on an episode of Criminal Minds, and she played a mother whose child had been kidnapped. And I cast her not knowing in a million fucking years that this actress herself had been kidnapped. Not once, but twice, and is a subject of a documentary that many of our listeners have seen. I am so glad she is here to tell us her story.
Wow. Thank you. What a wonderful introduction. I'm Jan Broberg, and I am an actress. I also run a theater. I love all of that part of my life, which probably saved my life as a kid, because I could do things on stage and cry and scream that I couldn't tell in my real life what was happening to me. My kidnapping was by a very, very dear friend that we thought was a very, very dear friend of our family, who was married with five kids of his own that we met at church. So that's my hope is to raise the awareness. It's not usually a scary stranger. It's usually somebody you know, you love, and you trust. So anyway, it's great to be here. Thank you so much.
And your documentary is called what, Jan? And you have a podcast with the same title. Can you tell everybody what it is?
Yes, it is called Abducted in Plain Sight, the Jan Broberg story, and currently it's on Netflix. Lots of wonderful feedback and stuff that has come out of that, and I'm looking at limited series on my story as well right now. So it's great. Hopefully we can make a difference in the world. That's why my family all decided that we were ready to tell our story 100% honestly and truthfully in hopes that we'd protect or save another kid.
It's an unbelievable story. It's almost, people can't believe it.
It is unbelievable. And I have to say this, in the writer's room at Criminal Minds, when it first came out, all the writers were talking about it and everybody basically said, oh, I got to watch it. And there are two things that everybody said. I wanted to smash my computer or throw my TV out the window. And there was a lot of anger that is engendered by this documentary. And in fact, people decided that it must be a mockumentary, that it could not be true. They were so blown away by the unreality of it. What do you say about that?
Well, that's interesting because what I got from doing, you know, going through the experience and having all of my family members and each of us, we were interviewed alone, not with each other. We were, you know, isolated basically. And it's so interesting because some of the things that my mother and my dad talked about in more detail to those documentary filmmakers than they had really talked to each other or to us about, we knew all of the various manipulations that this man and tactics that he had used on each and every member of the family. And I was so shocked at the reaction of the public because I know what wonderful parents I have and I know what human beings look like. And I'm like, wow, they're so judgmental and critical. Some people, not everybody. And I thought, have they never been conned? Has nobody out there ever had somebody that they trusted and then had something bad happen? I'm like, because that is the majority of what is happening to children. They are not being kidnapped, raped, molested, and brainwashed by scary strangers. It's by someone in their home, in their neighborhood, in their congregation, in their school system, in their community center, at the Boy Scouts. It isn't some scary stranger. It's 4 out of 10 kids that this happens to. And it's not by strangers, hardly ever. And so I was shocked that people were so shocked. But I also understand taking a 7-year story and, you know, getting it into 90 minutes, it was going to be shocking because, you know, we had 2.5, almost 3 years of knowing this family and becoming best friends. We'd done hundreds of activities with them. You know, it would have been like, if my parents died, who would have been in the will to take us, you know, and raise us? They would have been in the running along with my aunts and uncles and stuff. They would have been that trusted. And I'm like, I think the problem with all of that and the reaction was, oh, this means that you don't think it could happen to you. Oh, this means that you don't know it is happening to you. That's the problem.
That's the insidious nature of nice guy acquaintance offenders and grooming. And I think Jerry Sandusky was a perfect example of that, where people believed that it must be a conspiracy of people that encouraged and enabled him to do this when they didn't realize it was one extremely talented, manipulative offender who was sexually attracted to boys in that case. And in your case, the offender was sexually attracted to you.
Yeah, I think, Jan, I mean, having watched it a number of times now, because Abducted in Plain Sight actually aired in 2017, didn't it? And I remember at the time, just the amount of public outcry. And having watched it again yesterday, I still felt like that. But I feel that the difference here is that he inserted himself in his family, presented as a family man, and groomed everybody. And it's the level of manipulation, of exploiting each person's, let's call it, vulnerability in the family. And I think that part is what people really don't understand about this story, that he had the ability to gauge the emotional temperature with each of you. And his strategy, it was so persuasive. So it's much more about him than it is about you. But of course, you would want to ensure that when, I know you feel strongly about raising awareness, that the red flags, the warning signs are absolutely clear to people. And what was clear in this case was that you've got a grown man, he's got children himself, but he wants to spend more time with you than with anybody else. And that is a major red flag in and of itself.
You as a 12-year-old child. And I've said this a number of times, Laura's said this a number of times. The fact is that adults typically weary of engagements with children. Yes, they can put up with a certain amount of it. Yes, it's, you know, there are certain people who, you know, love kids and want to spend a great deal of time with them, but they typically wear out. They can't actually stay with a kid all the time. It drives them insane. And so if someone wants to spend more time with your child than you can stand spending with your child, that is an absolute red flag. That is something that you should stop, prevent, and then protect others from that same person. Not just protect your child, but protect everyone. Report it. Because if you don't, they just move to the next town and the next situation. And like Laura said, this guy was expert at grooming each person. What's unusual about this case, and I've worked literally tens of thousands of child sex crimes. So the difference is that in this case, the offender not only groomed all of the family members, at least the important ones that he had to manipulate in order to get access to you, but in fact, he sexually assaulted each one of them. They may have thought that they were voluntary participants in whatever activity they ended up doing with him. But the fact is, he was committing a crime. He was using that to actually sexually assault you. That's a crime. He was actually engaging in a premeditated pattern of behavior to get access to you as a child for sexual assault. And so those things were crimes. And every time I heard your mother or your father talk about the interactions they had with him, what was going off in my mind is they're victims of a crime right here, right now. That is a crime he's committed. He's using it to get to you. There's no question that he wasn't actually in love with your mother. There's no question that he didn't engage in that activity with your father because he was attracted to him or he needed release for some reason. None of that was actually true. It was a way to manipulate your father and your mother. But it also gave him the perfect extortion against them. And that's what he used it for.
Yeah, and it's really nice actually to have somebody put it in those kind of terms that understands that. And that's what I think the, maybe not the general public, I had a lot of really very appreciative people that said, I have words now for my own story because it happened by somebody in my family or in my neighborhood, congregation, whatever. And they said there was just no way to explain it until I saw your story. And then I was like, oh, well, that's because before they ever got to me, they had already manipulated my mom or my whoever it was that they befriended and that they became super good friend close to. And that's kind of like where you're saying there's like a they create a chaos in each individual's life, or they create a relationship, a special relationship, so that then that manipulation with that person keeps them focused on themselves, you know, instead of maybe seeing what I don't call red flags, because I think it's too obvious of a thing and they're not obvious. I think I call them little blue sound waves. Like, oh, I think that he has spent way too much time maybe with taking Jan and Jerry out. And why doesn't he want to do that more with the other girls and his other kids? And why is it always those two? Because generally speaking, there was only a handful of times, other than that I worked at his furniture store, you know, and got paid like a little person, you know, having her first little job or whatever. But he didn't take me alone, you know. I mean, that wasn't a common thing. And so again, it's more subtle than a red flag. It's more insidious than that. And you don't see them if you're worried about, why am I feeling attracted to this guy? I shouldn't have these feelings. I love my husband. I love my family. But you're having this crisis in your own self.
Right. It's a definite distraction and a deliberate one.
Deliberate, yeah. And it was very, very much a mapped out, planned out, deliberate manipulation technique, whatever you want to call it. But it was very real to my parents, who never, I think, you know, my father passed away before the documentary actually aired on Netflix and in November of 2018, 2 years ago. And I think he took it to his grave that somehow he should have known, he should have seen it, he should have protected his little girls. I mean, we were his whole life, you know, he was such a wonderful father. And I tried to tell him, Dad, you were just as victimized and manipulated and brainwashed as anybody else. And you know, we all came to terms with our relationships and the failures that we all, I mean, I don't feel like I failed anything, but I certainly was susceptible to all of that brainwashing and my parents, you know, even my mom, you know, she has a hard time. She's just like, you know, it was our fault. And I'm like, no, it was not, you know, and it's hard. That's hard on me because I think that a lot of times what people are sensing and why they're missing those, what I call blue sound waves that go through your chest. And you're like, did that teacher have his hand on my child's back for just 5 seconds too long? You know how you have a little thought, but I'm like, it's just like everything else. If you're brainwashed, you have a thought about something, but what's your second thought? Your second thought is the brainwashed thought. It's the, oh no, that can't be possible. That teacher got teacher of the year last year. What am I thinking? I'm so judgmental. It's the secondary thought. And that's what I tell people all the time. It's because your father or your child's grandfather, it couldn't be him. So if something were to happen and you were to have this little, they don't want to sit on grandpa's lap or they don't want to go see uncle so-and-so or they're, you know, they have a stomach ache every time Aunt Sally is going to babysit or whatever it is, you dismiss it because this is a person you know and love and that you think your child does too, and you're not going to let yourself go there.
My first impression when I saw Berchtold and his wife, Gail, I thought of them not quite matching because she was the quiet one. But she and I became really quite close friends.
Everybody had a best friend. You know, between the Brobergs and the Berchtold family, there was a best friend for everyone. We had some of our best family times when we were with the Berchtold family.
Berchtold would pick us up in the morning, and we would get in the car, and we would all shout together, "It's going to be a great day!" And that's how we would start our mornings.
I don't remember who came up with the idea that we started to call him B. Pretty much every day he would come by at night and talk to my parents, and he was so engaged with the kids too. I mean, he really was fun and he wanted to swing us around and put a puzzle together and, you know, I mean, he was the fun dad.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say there is a name for it, Jan, and it's called coercive control. And he coercively controlled everybody. And I don't know if you're familiar with the term coercive control.
I'm not.
I mean, I'm listening to you very carefully just because the way that you describe things is very important. And coercive control is a behavioral regime that's a strategy, a set of behaviors to exploit or to manipulate, to create domination and power and control over someone and entrap them using their biggest fears at times. And that entrapment is what keeps people quiet. And that is always the problem of not always knowing what that biggest fear is, as in why somebody might be silent. And the little voice in your head, more often, once you are being coercively controlled, the second voice tends to be the perpetrator's voice. And it's their voice you hear rationalizing and minimizing things, particularly the skilled abuser, which is what I see in a lot of my cases. If they're particularly skilled, they render the abuse invisible to everybody. And that invisibility is the problem, that other people don't see it. They see it as the innocent. They see it as they rationalize it. And that's always the challenge, particularly if you've got a power imbalance, i.e. an adult and a child. But even if you've got two adults, it's a very sophisticated thing. And it's so sophisticated, much more than adult and child grooming, because a child tends to trust an adult just based on trust of, I'm a child, you're an adult. But with adults, it's much more sophisticated because it means keying in to their vulnerabilities and the things that I felt that he did and showed his sort of level of master manipulator was with your mom, seeing that she didn't feel seen at times in the relationship. And he told her things that made her feel so good about herself. And that is a very powerful aphrodisiac. And so I don't think we should ever negate, you know, when we think about coercive control, how the perpetrators who are particularly skilled really key in and target and exploit every aspect of a person's character and personality. Their strengths become weaknesses. And that invisibility allows them to carry on to the next person, without any real challenge. And this was somebody who could talk his way out of most things. We can go back to the 70s, and was it really something that was talked about? I mean, not coercive control, for sure, but I think that that really does. We defined it in law in England and Wales, and it's now a crime in every part of the UK. It's just about to become a crime in Northern Ireland. And I'm leading a campaign here to criminalise coercive control, because it is something that is not very well understood. And everything that you were talking about just leads me to believe that he had the ability to exploit and create silence in people using their biggest fear at times. And he could talk his way around anything and everything. And yes, a lot of it is also about the fact he was a family man and he had children of his own. And therefore, when people did think things were off, he had that cover and that front. But I am curious about his wife, whether I'm happy for you to say something about what I'm describing, but I'm very keen to hear what you know about or what you understood about his wife and what was happening to her.
No, it's interesting. I've looked back, and my mom and I have talked a lot about this because she desperately wanted to continue a relationship with my mother and the children, even after they moved from Pocatello. This was in between the two kidnappings. And I just pulled out my sister's little diary and was reading some of the pages about how much she loved their second oldest son, because the oldest was my age. And then the next one, Jimmy, was Karen's age. And she was so in love with Jimmy. And, you know, she's writing this as an eight. You know, they moved into our area when I was 9. He kidnapped me when I was 12. And so Karen's 7, 8, 9, 10 during this time in between the two kidnappings, when she had gotten this little journal, and they were just about to move away. My dad had said, you know, we can't have anything to do with them. And of course, we were having none of that. I'm brainwashed. And of course, I have to see them. But I also love, I have, you know, notes about how much I'm in love with Jimmy, his oldest son, you know, who's also 13. And Karen, my sister, had all these diary entries about how much she was just so sad and how she missed, you know, Jimmy. And so you not only have the layer of this guy who has now made sure that all of us have a best friend in the relationship with all the children, but you've got him creating this thing with his wife where he's told my dad, you know, we don't have much of a relationship. I think I'm going to get a divorce. And then with my mom, oh, if only Gail could be blah, blah, blah. And I think his poor wife, I think she knew something because they had moved. I know of two girls before me that were molested by him, and I know of four girls after me. So wow. Those are the letters and the people and the things that have come to me because my story has come out. So I've actually talked to several of these people, and knowing what I know now, I think she knew something was wrong.
The documentary gave subtle hints of it. It didn't go into great detail of it, but the coup de grace, of course, was when she came to convince your parents to sign that deal. She was the arm of that extortion. She committed a crime by doing it. There's no question in my mind that she did, but she did it at his direction. There's no way she came up with this idea. There's no way it was her, but he forced her. He used the same kind of manipulations. I don't know what he did to her to get her to do that. But what do you think, Laura? What do you think was going on behind the scenes?
Well, that was exactly my point. When I heard that your parents did want to call the police, but the person who talked them around and down was the wife, was Gail. That was my first indicator that, you know, why would a mum She's got her own children as well. She could understand how distressing it would be for your parents in that situation. So what would make a mum turn around and say, please don't call the police? And so the indicators, I think, were there that she was being coercively controlled. And now you just furnish me with a little bit more detail about the condition he wanted her in. And I see that a lot, by the way. You know, if somebody is always meeting the other person's needs, but is never having their needs met, that's a clear sign that there's an imbalance in the relationship and probably someone's being coercively controlled. And I would imagine that she did most of his bidding and was quite good at it because he had taught her well. He was really the person behind it all. Like when you had to write the note the second time you left and people thought that it wasn't your note that was written. And I don't know whether it was he who told you how to write it, but I noticed you had called your parents by their first name. There was some distance being created and I intuited it was probably his version of what he wanted you to say. Is that accurate?
Yes, it's accurate. I can't tell you for sure if the actual, because I was actually given little paper that had points on it, but I think he told me that the paper had come from one of the, you know, Zeta or Zethra, and these were the things I needed to say in the note in my own words. And some of those things were almost word for word what was on that little paper that I remember. It was one of those things that was slipped to me by a student in an envelope at school. I used to get little notes and things, and it would tell me to go to XYZ phone booth at a certain time and sit on the ground and wait for the phone to ring. And it would either be him on the other end, or it would be that high-pitched monotone voice on the other end of the phone giving me instructions of what I was supposed to do next. So even little notes with such specific things about when I was to write the note and where I was to put it and what I was to put in the backpack and where I was to leave the backpack. And all of those things were definitely told to me to do them. So that's interesting. And I really understand also with her, which I think is another subtle thing for people to kind of maybe hook into, is that he may not have said to her, you have to protect me because I'm going to kidnap Jan Broberg. But the way that she was controlled by him again was through manipulation. And, you know, she wasn't a working woman. This is the 70s when most every single, at least person in my church, in my, you know, neighborhoods, mom stayed home. Nobody worked. I mean, you might go help out once in a while, but you were home, you know, and that right. was her. And she had five kids. She had no skills that I know of to go and have a job. So whatever the reasons were that she protected him, whether something had happened previously, which is what I had kind of thought, like they've moved around a bit. And now I know there were two others before me. They weren't kidnapped, but they were definitely sexually assaulted by this man as little girls, one at 9 and one at 11, maybe almost 12. And I just look at that and think, she knew something to beg my parents not to call the police. There's something there. So right. That's interesting what you said.
Bert Stoll had called me earlier in the day and said, I want to take Jan out horseback riding down in American Falls. Bert Stoll comes driving up to my house and said, okay, I'm ready to take you, Jan. She came in the back door.
I was like, oh, yes, 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 I want to go.
I said, you better be back before Bob gets home for dinner. I'll have her back.
I said, I brought your allergy pills, you know, you should take one of those before we go to the horses. Downed that, and off we went. I must have passed out pretty quickly because I have no recollection of getting to the stables, no recollection of the drive, no recollection of him.
When she didn't come home, I was a little nervous, anxious. Maybe they broke down. Around 9 o'clock at night, Bert Stoll's wife, Gail, came over, worried. And I said, maybe I should call the state police. Oh, don't do anything. I'm sure he'll be coming any minute. And so we waited. That was Thursday that they went horseback riding. We had Friday, didn't call anybody, didn't want to upset Gail.
And this went on for about 2 days. And I said, Mary Ann, we better get the law involved so we need some help to find them.
On Saturday morning, I dialed the FBI. They said, the office is closed for the weekend. If you have an emergency, call this office in Butte, Montana. I didn't follow through because I thought, I don't want to get all these people all worked up over nothing. And so we waited. Another night came and went, and then it was Sunday. Well, let's just, if they're not back by Sunday, we'll call.
How about the fact that he basically changed your name to Dolly, basically depersonalizing you and actually, I mean, making you isolated from your family and also controlling you? Like, he gave you this name. It wasn't like he asked you. It wasn't like there was no reason for him to do it other than this is a way to separate you from your prior life. This is a way to build a wall between you and the people that loved you who would protect you.
Yeah.
So I have so many questions for all of you. If I just want to recap for listeners who may not have seen the show yet, but you should. So in the lead up to him kidnapping you, you know, he would take you on special excursions, special trips. And this is what gets me so angry at the community where you were living in, is that people knew that it was odd. That you have somebody in the documentary, a neighbor, who says he went out boating with you and B, and he knew there was something wrong with this relationship, and he literally turned his back on it. He wanted to...
I'm not going to be involved anymore.
As though you are part of what's disgusting him. And I'm sure all of these people, so many people in the community could have helped
you. The FBI agent describes it and says that you and him had an unnatural relationship. Excuse me? I mean, you're an FBI agent. This is a crime, a federal crime, and you don't even realize that what you're saying is bringing guilt and blame on the victim? That's bullshit.
So there are people in your church, your own bishop. And the other thing, Jan, I know that you're used to a lot of people watching this documentary and being very angry at your parents. And hello, I was one of them. And I understand through Jim and Laura's teaching, I understand grooming. I understand the grooming of adults. But what I didn't understand was the line that your parents allowed B to come into your bedroom at night and sleep with you at night with their permission. Because I don't understand, would that have been okay for your dad to go over to the Bechtold's house and sleep with one of his daughters? I mean, crossing those lines for me are...
But that's where the documentary is incomplete.
Okay.
That's where having a series will be able to explain so much more, because he never slept with me all night in my bed under the covers. That is erroneous information in the documentary, or how people took it. Mm-hmm. But this is how it actually was. He came over with these tapes that he had gotten from supposedly a psychiatrist. And even when I was on Dr. Oz, he told me the name of that therapy. I can't remember what it is now, something associative therapy or something. He said, oh, it was a thing in the 70s. Because I'd been telling people this on many talk shows and not knowing, you know, if this was just something he made up or whatever. He goes, oh, no, it was debunked later. But it was a definite thing, because you have to remember, in the 70s, there was not all of this, mental counseling and psychotherapy. It was just starting to come into play. And so anyway, it's interesting, because what he would do is he would come over. I'd already been tucked in bed by my dad, we'd either tickled backs and we'd read a story or we'd had a discussion or whatever. I mean, my mom or my dad put us to bed every single night. So first of all, there's a person, an adult, that literally makes sure that you've said your prayers and you've gotten in bed and they've laid by you. Okay, so first of all, you have to know that that's the kind of home I grew up in. It was awesome and it was perfect. I had a perfect childhood until this guy came along. And so first of all, that isn't an unusual thing. So my bedroom is at the end of the hallway downstairs. My mom is always downstairs ironing, doing laundry. That's where all of that happened. And so when he came and said, I'm trying to overcome this depression that I had, it started when I was about age 10. It was because of some abuse that I suffered. And this guy, this psychiatrist, this expert, this professional has given me these tapes, and I'm supposed to lay by a child who is about that same age and listen to these tapes, and it's supposed to help me. And by this time, you know, I think I'm 12 by now. I haven't been kidnapped yet, but it's going to happen pretty soon. Maybe I'm 11. But it was not that long before he actually, you know, pulled the plug and did it. So my bedroom door is open. My mom said, I'm going in and out. I'm putting clothes away. He's laying there on the bed with these big headphones on outside of the bed, not under the covers. He's listening to these things. It would last for anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes. And then he'd get up and come upstairs and we'd have a conversation and he'd go home. You were asleep. Right.
But then he'd go home and I'm certain, or somewhere else, and masturbate to those same tapes. Because probably, what he was doing was associating you, laying in bed with you, this small child who wasn't even a teenager yet, and he's fantasizing sexually about you. There's no question in my mind about that. So yes, on the surface, I can see where you, from a 12-year-old's perspective, who has had parents laying in bed with her in a very innocent way and loving way, and then being asked to let him, who is another adult who you looked up to and the family loved and had fun with, from your perspective, but it actually allowed him access to you that he would never have had without your parents' permission. And here's the problem with it. Even if it was wonderful therapy for this guy, he used you for the therapy. Your parents let him use you for the therapy. And that's a problem. Parents should never let their kids be used for any reason by another person. For any reason. And I'll say that again. Parents should never let their kids be used by another person. And that is something that you can't just not acknowledge. You can't just say, oh, well, they thought it was okay. So what I'm saying is I also felt a great deal of anger, especially the second time I watched it. None of it at all directed at you, by the way. None of it directed at you. But the vast majority of it directed at the offender, but I also got angry at your parents because time after time after time, they gave him the benefit of the doubt rather than you. And that's where the issue lies. Parents need to understand that they are the best last line of defense for their children. Their children should be educated, and there's a lot of good books, and we'll post them on our site along with this episode. But the parents have to take responsibility, and they had to know that he had children your same age, and it wasn't necessary for him to come to your house to do this. They let him do that, and that's the biggest issue I have with them. Again, I'm glad that you were able to forgive them. I'm glad that they were able to forgive themselves. I'm glad that you were able to, as a family, move on. That's an incredibly important healing step to become a survivor. I'm a survivor myself. I went through something. Nothing is as extreme as what you went through, but it took me time to get through it. And forgiveness is a part of that. But what I'm saying is you're in a position now. You're a spokesperson for the world. So many millions of people have seen this and will see it and read your book and your mother's book and hopefully we'll see this series that you're about to do. But the fact is, we have to make sure that everybody along the line, everybody along that chain is responsible, because children are not mentally capable, developmentally capable of making proper decisions. And when it gets to the point where things are getting really rough in the family because you are desperate to try to continue your mission and you're making life miserable for everybody else, that is not a valid reason for, again, letting somebody use you.
And I absolutely, I'm completely agree, because that's my biggest thing, is to make sure that the awareness is so that parents, I mean, and that, you know, we're talking to the parents who actually really care and love their children. There's plenty of offenders who are a parent. I think the point that I just wanted to make, though, is that, again, somebody that talks the right talk and you think they know more than you, like, oh, they're talking about a psychiatrist that's told him to do this. And, right, and he had an aunt that abused him, and they don't even know what that even means. I mean, they'd never heard of a pedophile. My mom and dad had heard of a child molester, but even the FBI agent that you talked about earlier had to go kind of look it up, right, to say, well, this is exactly what it is. And also our friend and neighbor who actually, again, was one of my father's dearest friends, and that family, we grew up with their kids too. They just lived across the street. Cor Hoffman is who you were talking about. I don't think he remember. I think when he's interviewed and he's in his 80s for this documentary, the memory doesn't serve so well. He might have had a funny feeling, but he didn't know anything either.
Right.
And I think that that's the point, is that this kind of offender, this kind of manipulation is so subtle. I mean, this guy worked. The one thing I will say is that that same gentleman who said that about, he didn't want anything to really, he didn't want to really get involved with that family after that one experience. They were very involved with that family. I can show you a letter. Again, the documentary isn't finished. There's tons more to talk about. I can show you a letter that that same man, who is our dear friend, and his he's dead now too, but his children are still our dear friends, that he wrote a letter of recommendation for Berchtold and his wife to go to Mexico and adopt a girl, a child.
Wow.
They were on their way. It's not in the documentary. That it didn't make it in there, but I can show you that same thing. So it's like,
no, I know. No, we get that. And, okay. And you're absolutely right. But what we want to teach our listeners is that is the difference between knowing and the funny feeling. You don't have to know.
Right.
You have to protect children. So if you get a funny feeling, it's your responsibility to know, learn, dig in.
And
make
ask
sure.
More questions.
Exactly.
You know, that's the important part of keep asking questions about someone's behavior when you trust your gut instinct. Well, Jan, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. And we've learned so much just hearing you talk. Obviously, you can only put so much in a documentary. But to all of our listeners, please do watch the documentary Abducted in Plain Sight. And we still have so much more to talk to you about, Jan, in particular, in a serial perpetrators, those who go from one victim to the next, to the next, to the next. And we really want to educate our listeners about that. So many more questions, and we really appreciate you giving us your time. And for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the exonerated five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.